And hello again to all. I am Paul Weber. It is my job and my honor to welcome you to the Basic Principles of Cleaning, Disinfection, and Sterilization in Healthcare. This is the second teleclass in a four-part series for novice ICPs that we're doing this month. And by the number of registered sites for this teleclass, I can safely conclude, I think, that it is a very popular topic. In the last few years, I have had the privilege of introducing Dr. Lynn C. Hulster 5 times, this time being the fifth. At least 3 of those lectures are available for free in our recordings library. And as you'll see by the title slide, Dr. C. Hulster works with the CDC Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. She's been with the CDC for about 11 years, I think. Before that, she served as an infectious disease epidemiologist at the Texas Department of Health, and that was, I think, for 15 years. Her area of expertise focuses on environmental microbiology and the transmission of infectious diseases. She advises the government and healthcare professionals and the public on issues concerning environmental infection control, sterilization and disinfection, prion disease epidemiology, and environmental management of emerging diseases and agents of bioterrorism. And when there is a hepatitis C outbreak in a Nevada clinic potentially affecting 40,000 people, Lynn C. Hulster's phone rings a lot. So, to present the teleclass, the basic principles of cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization in healthcare from beautiful Atlanta, Georgia, I am pleased to turn the floor over to Dr. Lynn C. Hulster. Lynn.
Oh, my gosh, Paul. I don't think I can live up to that introduction. Let's go to slide number 2, and I will just let you look at that while I welcome today's audience. I'm pleased that the Weber Training Teleconference Series has prepared lectures designed to give infection control professionals who are new to the field the basics and some of the subjects that are so central to the practice of preventing infections in healthcare settings. Let's go to slide 3. Today's presentation, and I will apologize up front, there is a lot of material here, some of which will be take home for your reading and enjoyment at a later time, which is what I call the bonus material. I will do my best to cover what we have before that bonus material in the time we have today. Anyway, today's presentation will focus on the fundamental principles of cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization, all of which are key in the comprehensive environmental management program. I won't be covering many of the new developments in the field, as I believe this will be addressed at a teleconference later in the year. But as I said, I'm going to go through these slides fairly quickly, and so let's get started. Okay, let's go to slide number 4. Preventing the transmission of infection is a complex process, so we must first understand how infections initiate their process. This concept is known as the chain of infection and was developed by Professor Willie Green back in the late 1960s. He reasoned that for infections to take place, there must be 5 factors that must be in place. There must be, first, a virulent pathogen. 2, there must be sufficient numbers of this pathogen to initiate infection, what we call an infectious dose. 3, there must be a susceptible host. 4, there must be a mode of transmission or a means of moving pathogens from point A to point B. And finally, number 5, the pathogen must enter the host through the correct portal of entry. If any one of these 5 factors is missing from the picture, infections will not occur. When we're called upon to develop infection control strategies, it is very helpful to keep this chain of infection concept in mind. Slide number 5. Microorganisms can be found in the environment and are also associated with people. Microorganisms, however, do not move about by themselves. They depend on the flow of environmental media, such as air and water, and they depend on transfer to and from patients, healthcare workers, surfaces, and fomites. The frequency and efficiency of these transfers are highly varied, and so therefore not known exactly. But we do know there are two key elements to these transfers, our hands and the bioburden, the microbial content on surfaces and fomites. Slide number 6. This is the first of two slides, and this is all I'm going to say about hand washing and hand hygiene, because this is a topic of numerous teleconferences, and we cannot say enough about hand washing and hand hygiene. The more we do it, the better off we will be. What can we say? It is a prime means of preventing the transfer of pathogens to and from patients and surfaces. And slide number 7, our second of two hand hygiene slides. When we practice hand hygiene on a routine basis, we have observed that the rates of healthcare-acquired infections will drop. Certainly an incredibly important practice. By minimizing or eliminating the bioburden on our hands, we help to remove that transfer factor from the chain of infection. As I say, that's it for hand washing. Better do it, because it works, and the more we do it, the better we will be. Let's move to slide number 8. With this slide, we'll begin looking at cleaning, disinfecting, and sterilization. So let's start off with an introduction to some of the terminology. In the beginning, there was cleaning. Cleaning reduces bioburden on surfaces and objects so they are safe to handle. As the first step in a reprocessing scheme, a reusable surface or item, it is the ability of cleaning to remove bioburden, and it serves to enhance the effectiveness of the microbial inactivation process that would follow that step. Cleaning is sometimes referred to as decontamination, but more often than not, we associate the word decontamination with processes such as body substance, spill cleanup, or spill cleanup in laboratories, and you will find some information about biological spill cleanup in your bonus materials. Slide number 9 is disinfection. It is a process by which microorganisms are destroyed, inactivated, or eliminated. Disinfection, however, is a less lethal process compared to sterilization, in that disinfection does not inactivate bacterial spores to the same extent as sterilization. A disinfectant, therefore, is a substance, usually a liquid chemical, that destroys or eliminates infectious microorganisms, but not necessarily bacterial spores, in the inanimate environment. Now, in some instances, you may see the word sanitizer or sanitization. In a sense, this is another microbial inactivation process. We see these terms commonly used in areas such as food service. Very commonly, you'll see food service sanitizers in these areas. For example, a sanitizer means a substance that reduces bacterial populations in the inanimate environment by significant numbers, but does not destroy or eliminate all bacteria or other microorganisms. So in a sense, it is perhaps even less lethal compared to disinfection, but nevertheless can make surfaces safe to use. Let's go to slide number 10. There are three levels of disinfection that we commonly have available to us in healthcare. These are low-level disinfection, intermediate-level, and high-level disinfection. The first is low-level. This level of potency is capable of inactivating most vegetative bacteria, some viruses and fungi, but not microbacteria. Low-level disinfectants are commonly used to disinfect housekeeping surfaces in healthcare, and a frequent class of compounds that you will see for this purpose is that of quaternary ammonium compounds. In slide 11, intermediate level disinfection, this level will inactivate vegetative bacteria and fungi and most of the viruses and will kill mycobacteria. Intermediate level disinfectants are commonly used for management of spills of blood and body substances. What you find among intermediate level disinfectants are a number of chlorine containing compounds such as bleach, other chlorine containing cleaners like calcium hypochlorite. So there are a number of products with sufficient, more potency compared to low-level disinfectants and will kill a broader spectrum of microorganisms. In slide 12, high-level disinfection will inactivate all microorganisms, including some bacterial spores. But the sporicidal activity does not match that of sterilization, which will inactivate spores in high numbers. These are a class of very powerful chemical disinfectants, and you will find a number with significant oxidative properties, such as the peroxides and parasitic acids, and also compounds that whose form of action is primarily with protein fixation, usually seen with the aldehydes, such as glutaraldehyde or formaldehyde. Slide 13 is the topic of sterility. The most potent of all the microbial inactivation processes is sterilization, that which is capable of producing a state of sterility. From one perspective, this is a state that is free from living microorganisms. But when we use a sterilization process, the question is, how do we define that? While the state of sterility is an absolute state, an item is either sterile or it is not, the process of sterilization is not easy to define, and normally you will see it defined in terms of a probability. In practical terms, this is the probability of a surviving microorganism being present on a surface in a chance of 1 in 1 million. And this is something that dates way back to the days when canning companies were trying to work out a process by which they could safely prepare canned tuna. So this has a long history of trying to find a statistically valid process that could be successfully used time and time again. Let's see. In slide 14, we have a number of processes that can accomplish sterilization. These will be either physical processes, usually those of heat or radiation. There are liquid chemical sterilants. There are also gases and gas plasmas. You'll note that the liquid chemical sterilants, by and large, are the same chemical compounds as high-level disinfectants. The principal difference in achieving high-level disinfection versus liquid chemical sterilization is the use conditions, and this is primarily due to the length of the contact time, whereas high-level disinfection may occur in perhaps as few as 20 minutes when exposed to a high-level disinfectant. In order to achieve a sterilization process, the exposure or contact time may be as long as 10 or more hours. In slide 15, this is a slide that depicts not only the intrinsic levels of resistance among microorganisms, but also shows how the different inactivation processes, the disinfection levels and sterilization, relate to those intrinsic levels of microbial resistance. You can see the bacterial spores being among the most highly resistant of microbial forms will be inactivated by primarily sterilization and to some extent high-level disinfection. And going all the way down the list where you see microorganisms that are incredibly sensitive to disinfecting properties among lipid-containing viruses and vegetative bacteria. Now that we've gone through the microbial inactivating processes, we'll see how this applies to the instruments and surfaces that we process. Let's go to slide 16 and then quickly to slide 17. Here we introduce the Spalding classification for medical instruments and devices. Back in the 1970s, Dr. Earl Spalding proposed a classification scheme for medical instruments and devices to help with the decision process about what we would do for instrument reprocessing. The Spalding classification identifies three categories of instruments, and these are critical, semi-critical, and non-critical. In 1991, CDC scientists put forth a modification to Dr. Spalding's classification and added a fourth category, that of environmental surfaces. This is a separate category of surfaces, and these items normally do not touch the patient. Consequently, CDC did not indicate or intend for the environmental surfaces to be lumped together with non-critical instruments and devices. The distinction between the two is that non-critical medical devices will touch the patient, and invariably and commonly the environmental surfaces, such as the housekeeping surfaces, generally do not. So there is the distinction between those items. In slide 18, we're looking at the definitions of each of these instrument categories. These are based primarily on the likelihood or the potential for infection to occur if an instrument is brought into contact with different body tissues and qualities of the body tissue, whether it's sterile or mucous membrane, the likelihood that infection would occur if an item were contaminated when it is used in a medical procedure. So critical instruments are those that penetrate mucous membranes and make contact with either the bloodstream or normally sterile areas of the body. It is critical, therefore, that this item used in a medical procedure making contact with those tissues be sterile to avoid the transmission of infection. And as you can see here, there are a few examples of what would be critical instruments, and they're given here on this slide. In slide 19, we list the definition of semi-critical instruments. These instruments make contact with mucous membranes or occasionally non-intact skin, but they normally do not penetrate to make contact with the bloodstream or other sterile areas of the body. Dr. Spalding viewed mucous membranes as tissues where microorganisms may be naturally present, so the need for sterile instruments, while preferred, is not absolute. You'll see we have some examples of semi-critical instruments here, and invariably there are a number of instruments, some that are as complex as endoscopes and laryngoscopes, down to simple devices such as dental mouth mirrors and specula. In slide number 20, the non-critical instruments and devices, these are items which make contact with intact skin. Among the categories of instruments, these carry the least risk of transmitting infection, and we all know intact skin is an excellent barrier to microorganisms. Consequently, it is not critical that these items be sterile before they are used for the patient. Having gone through this this series of definitions and the intended uses of instruments, let's see how we now apply these concepts to assigning levels of reprocessing to these instruments. Let's go to slide 21. This is where we show you the appropriate levels of instrument reprocessing needed to make the various categories of instruments safe for the next patient encounter. Sterilization for critical instruments, sterilization or high-level disinfection for semi-critical instruments, and intermediate to low-level disinfection for non-critical instruments. Low-level disinfection is usually adequate for the management of environmental surfaces, although we do sometimes use intermediate-level disinfection when we are in the process of doing blood or body substance spill management. Okay, now we will move on to cleaning, and let's go to slide 22. What can we say? The most important step, in our opinion, for instrument reprocessing or surface management is cleaning. You cannot speak less highly of this simple process. Cleaning is so incredibly important to the success of everything we do from this point forward when it comes to managing instruments and or environmental surfaces. In slide 23, let's look at the steps of instrument or surface reprocessing, and cleaning is the first of these as well. Cleaning removes bioburden, removes soil, microorganisms, and helps to ensure the success of the reprocessing steps that follow. You can do this as either a manual process or with some of the more advanced technology today in reprocessing, automated cleaners, ultrasonic baths. Many of the cleaning products available today have surfactants or are enzyme detergents. These are all active components, all of which will loosen and lift soil from surfaces to be rinsed away. When you look in slides 24 and 25, you can see that cleaning as a means of removing bioburden can actually result in the reduction, the log reduction of bacterial populations on instruments and surfaces. And in many instances, this can be sometimes very important when you are dealing with instruments that may have a large amount of bioburden, such as colonoscopes or rectal thermometers or things that would come into contact with large quantities of organic matter. In some instances, from some studies, especially in slide number 25, there have been studies that have shown that in instances, effective cleaning can sometimes remove as much as 4 logs of microbial bioburden. So this is encouraging news and shows you that when you remove away the organic matter that can interfere with the activity of active ingredients and sterilants in our disinfectants and sterilizing processes, then you enhance the success of the process overall. In slide 26, we have some factors that will affect the outcome of reprocessing, whether this is a sterilization process or a disinfection process. As you can see, and in capital letters, the amount of bioburden organic material is among the most important of these factors. So the more bioburden present on an instrument or surface, the more the material will consume the active antimicrobial agent and take it out of solution or out of the picture. The factors listed in the second group on this slide pertain to the use conditions of the active antimicrobial agent during reprocessing. And a number of these will be commonly used with our liquid chemical disinfectants. Let's cover briefly some topics that are relevant to sterilization. In slide 27 is our transition slide. Slide 28 first looks at some of the instrument factors that can affect the success of a sterilization process. And you can see that the simpler the design and construction of an instrument, the easier it will be to clean and ultimately reprocess the instrument either with sterilization or with disinfection. In this case, we'll focus with sterilization. Cleaning, let's see, where are we? If you start off with a simple instrument, as I said, it is easier to clean it and remove bioburden. But as you can see, when you have lumens, which are narrow channels running through the length of a tube, or mated surfaces, acute angles, springs and valves, inaccessible areas, all of these will pose a challenge to the ability of the cleaning chemicals to penetrate to those areas, and ultimately in a sterilizing process for the ability of the sterilant to reach all of these surfaces. In order for an item to be fully successfully sterilized, the sterilant must make contact with all surfaces of the item. In slides 24 and 25, we have listed the attributes of the ideal sterilant, and these are dealt with in two groups of issues. We have first some of the items which are good qualities for a sterilant. It is a highly potent chemical or a highly potent physical process. It is rapidly acting. It has a strong permeability, therefore can penetrate throughout a load of devices or items placed in a sterilizer. A sterilizing process that is compatible with the materials being sterilized is obviously a desirable characteristic. And there are certainly also some safety issues, too. When a sterilant is used properly in accordance with how a manufacturer intends the use of that chemical or that physical agent, it should be a safe process. Nevertheless, there are things that we do take into account when sterilizers are running. In slide 31, we do know that as a sterilizing process, again, the success of this process is also affected by the conditions under which the process is run. We all know that a sterilizer is a complex engineered system, and the operation therein is dependent on, in some instances, critically controlled operating conditions. Each process, whether it be physical or liquid or gas or plasma, has a number of factors that are critical to the success of a good run. For a physical process, we look at time, temperature, relative humidity, liquid processes. It is important to monitor the use conditions of the liquid chemical sterilant. In some instances, with one system, the temperature of the water is important for the process. For gas, such as ethylene oxide or hydrogen peroxide gas plasma, not only is time and temperature important, but relative humidity and the gas concentration as well. So each of these have to be closely monitored and should be running to manufacturer's specifications. In slide 32, we will look at the elements of moist heat sterilization. This is basically the process that we have all come to know and love as primarily steam autoclaving, steam under pressure. The sterilization cycle for this system usually consists of four phases, which are listed here. The sterilant, in this case, is steam, and it is introduced into the chamber where you have your items to be sterilized. There follows an exposure period, and then the steam is removed from the chamber. The contents cool down and dry before removal from the equipment and before they are then returned to service. In slide 33, we look at the topic of air evacuation. In a steam autoclave, the presence of air prevents the steam from reaching all points of the load, so it is necessary to remove the air as the first step of the process. The mechanism of air removal defines the two major types of autoclaves. A gravity displacement sterilizer will use the weight of steam to force the air out through a portal at the bottom of the sterilizer chamber. A pre-vacuum or porous load autoclave, on the other hand, relies on several cycles of a vacuum, drawing a vacuum to pump the air out. In slide 34 and 35, we have two slides that discuss basically the item called flash sterilization. These two slides depict the use of a shortened sterilization cycle. This approach uses a higher steam temperature for a shortened exposure period. Flash sterilization as a process is ideally limited to sterilizing unwrapped instruments when they are needed quickly, such as when a dropped instrument in surgery is needed to the continuation of the surgical procedure. The item can be quickly cleaned, sterilized in a steam autoclave with a flash cycle, and returned to the surgery procedure in a relatively short turnaround of time. Flash sterilization, however, is a practice that is limited only to the use of steam autoclaves, and we do not see this as a recommended process with any of the low-temperature systems. We also do not generally recommend that a flash sterilization cycle be used when sterilizing implantable orthopedic devices. The second of the two slides, slide number 35, shows you the parameters of operation for flash cycles. These are basically the recommendations from either AAMI, which is the Association for the Advancement of Medical Instrumentation, or AORN, which is the Association of Perioperative Registered Nurses, I think. Or they may have changed their name since, but that's what I used to know them as. In slide 36, low-temperature processes. There are several low-temperature sterilizing processes available today, and all of which were developed to address a need that is unique with more contemporary medical devices, and that is the appearance of the heat-sensitive instrument and device. As you know, many of our instruments these days are heat-stable, but a significant number are heat-sensitive and cannot tolerate the high temperatures in autoclaves or the even dry heat ovens. In slide 37, these are generally the chemicals and the gases that are typically used with low temperature sterilization. You will see in many hospitals liquid systems involving parasitic acid. Many sterilizers in hospitals also use hydrogen peroxide gas plasma. And in some instances, although I understand this is being somewhat phased out, you will still see ethylene oxide sterilizers. Although here in the U.S., the EPA, our Environmental Protection Agency, has just recently put forward some more regulatory language regarding the safety of emissions from ethylene oxide sterilizers, and so that is available from our EPA website. All of these processes, either ethylene oxide, hydrogen peroxide gas plasma, or parasitic acid, can be used to process a heat-sensitive device. Slide 38, this is some wisdom from Walter Bond. You may have seen his name tossed about with sterilizer and disinfection issues. It may be tempting to throw all of your instruments into one of the low-temperature sterilizers, but I can tell you that environmental microbiologists such as Walter Bond will tell you that if you have a heat-stable instrument, the proper and safest method of sterilizing this instrument is to cook it in an autoclave. You don't dunk it, you don't gas it, you cook it. You can't get any better than that. In slide 39 through 42, for the sake of time, I think what I will do is just very briefly refer to these slides covering indicators used with sterilizers in healthcare. The main reason for summarizing these very briefly is the material in here is fairly straightforward. And in the bonus material, you'll find slides that will address the decision-making process when an indicator would suggest that the success of a sterilizer run is called into question. So I think what we will do is just tell you briefly that there are three general categories of indicators basically biological indicators, chemical indicators, and physical parameter indicators. The biological indicators, historically and traditionally, were populations of bacterial spores that were placed on a carrier or in a vial, and this would be placed within the most difficult point to reach within a load of instruments or materials in an autoclave. And these would be run along with a load of instruments. The indicator would be removed and sent for culture, and the results reported back to determine whether or not that particular run was successfully discharged. A biological indicator is perhaps the most critical of the three indicators because this is a real indication of the process's success or failure. If a biological indicator shows no growth, this signifies that sterilizing conditions were present and that the sterilant was able to penetrate into the location where the indicator was placed. It, however, does not tell you that the contents are sterile. It just tells you that sterilizing conditions were present during that particular run of the autoclave. With a chemical indicator, these will either turn color or give you some visual indication to the same event that sterilizing conditions were achieved. But a chemical indicator usually will focus on perhaps one parameter, such as time or temperature. In some instances, if a sterilizing temperature was achieved for a particular length of time that would be needed to cause a color change on the indicator, that is one type or one example of a chemical indicator. And physical parameter indicators are usually the dials and the digital readouts that we have on our equipment that will give you a real-time measure of what is happening during the run. Anyway, let us go to slide number 43. And this is the one entitled General Points to Consider. This kind of highlights some of the elements that you would possibly include on a checklist if you were doing quality assurance purposes when it comes to cleaning and reprocessing instruments for your sterilization of the instruments. In some instances, this checklist type point can also be applied for disinfection, particularly high-level disinfection of instruments. And speaking of disinfection, we will transition to disinfection of environmental surfaces. This is another major part of environmental management, with slide 44 as our transition slide. Slide 45 is a picture with lots of green little X's all over it. Environmental contamination can come from patients in the vicinity of their beds, or from hand transfer when healthcare staff move from patient to surface to equipment with gloved hands. And as you can see from this photograph, the potential to contaminate the patient environment can be quite high. With slide 46, it's important to recognize that the environment may serve as a reservoir of microorganisms, but surfaces are usually only indirectly involved in transmission of infection, and it's primarily the surfaces that are frequently touched that are involved. This is where we should target our use of intensive cleaning and disinfection strategies. In slides 47 and 48, these are factors that we consider when choosing a disinfectant and the procedure by which we use these products. Pre-cleaning the surface is important, just as it is for sterilization. A pre-clean surface will enhance the success of the disinfection process. It's also important that you have materials compatibility. between the disinfectant's active ingredients and the surfaces to be treated. It makes little sense to use a disinfectant on a surface if the chemical in that disinfectant damages the surface or limits its use life. In slide 48, we depict the use conditions of the disinfectant products that should be taken into account. If you were to look, for example, at the labels of disinfectant products, most of these items would be addressed. So therefore, in order to take each one of these into account, following the label instructions is especially important, and it's especially true if you're using a commercially produced product. The manufacturer, more often than not, has determined the best practice to use the product to its greatest potential. Now, as you might guess, there are incredible numbers of disinfectant products on the market, and the EPA in the U.S. has helped us out in a little bit by trying to group some of these disinfectant products into different lists, which will help us identify things that, for example, could be used to inactivate hepatitis B virus or Mycobacteria tuberculosis. And you will see this on slide 49. The numbers of lists has expanded greatly over the last few years from about 5 lists. Now we're up to about 8 or 9. So they're trying to help us out by identifying products and grouping them in lists, because they have a common target organism or a common procedure, such as medical waste treatment, involved. In slide 50, let's talk a little bit about something that you see on the labels of disinfectants many times, and that is the word hospital disinfectant. In the States, this is actually an EPA use category as part of their registration process. The manufacturer of that disinfectant usually has data to support inactivation claims for 3 key hospital pathogens: Staphylococcus aureus, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and Salmonella cholera suis. Generally, these hospital disinfectants are typically low-level disinfectants, or they can be intermediate-level disinfectants if the manufacturer demonstrates there is sufficient potency of the product to inactivate mycobacteria. Another interesting EPA regulatory term, a tuberculocidal disinfectant, in slide 51. These are simply a term to indicate a general level of potency for the product. As you know, TB is not transmitted by environmental surfaces, so the use of a tuberculocidal disinfectant will not be an essential factor in interrupting the spread of TB. Slide 52, we certainly admonish you all not to use high-level disinfectants on environmental surfaces. Most of these powerful chemicals are intended to be used for immersion purposes in closed containment, and there are certainly occupational hazards involved if these products are used in the open air. With cleaning and disinfecting of various surfaces and items in the healthcare environment, let's go to slide 53. First thing, let's talk about medical equipment. When medical equipment is concerned, it's important to follow label instructions not only for the use of the cleaning chemical and or the disinfecting chemical, but also for the equipment itself. You may find that many pieces of medical equipment are complex in their design, and they have sensitive electronics as part of their operation. You have to look at these pieces of equipment closely. Many times their electronics are not housed in watertight compartments, and it may be necessary to use something such as a barrier to prevent water or liquid from penetrating to the electronics and to help preventing the surfaces of these equipments from becoming contaminated in the first place. Slide 54, large housekeeping surfaces. In general, these are cleaned. There are probably times and opportunities where disinfection may be appropriate. But I would have to say that if there was ever some disagreement about appropriate environmental strategy, it has to be centered with the floors. I have yet to see true bona fide evidence that infections can be transmitted from the floors, so I see little benefit to routine disinfection of floors. Slide 55, however, would tell you that newer technology, such as the use of microfiber mops and mopping systems, may help bring us to some common ground here. The use of microfiber mops can enhance the efficiency of bioburden removal when they are used with detergent cleaning. And if you look at the log reduction in this particular study, you'll see that these log reductions approximate the same results as when the floors are disinfected after cleaning. In slide 56, our emphasis for environmental management should be first on cleaning and then disinfecting surfaces near the patient and the surfaces that are touched frequently by hand. This strategy is discussed at length in the CDC HCPCS guidelines for isolation and control of multiple drug-resistant organisms. Material and comments regarding the environmental control of such organisms is located in your bonus material. Slide 57. Summarizes one study that I think addresses a problem that we perhaps have not spent a great deal of time with previously. I think when we look at our efforts to prevent the hand transfer of microorganisms, we should also take a close look at our glove use strategy. As you can see from the data in this slide, researchers noted that healthcare workers in one hospital were observed to touch many items or surfaces in patients before gloves were changed. And they determined that approximately 18% of the microbiological samples that they collected in their study showed potential transfer of microorganisms between patients, gloves, and surfaces. I think this underscores the need to examine critically our strategies for glove use in patient care delivery, efforts we can do to help avoid glove misuse. In slide 58, cleaning can make a difference. This particular study was done recently in Chicago that looked at the impact of increased emphasis on cleaning and disinfection on the nosocomial rates of vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. Briefly, there was one period in their study, where they put more emphasis on more frequent cleaning and allowing more time for the process. And when they looked at the rates of VRE infections during that time, the rates appeared to go down. The rates appeared to fall even further when there was increased emphasis on hand hygiene. Now, I will note there are limitations to studies such as this one, and the main one that I see in this and other literature articles about looking at environmental management is many times you won't see adequate details about the cleaning process itself, how it was done, what disinfectants or detergents were used, and what they did during the process of cleaning. Did they use one wipe for several surfaces or one mop for several rooms? Some of these details are important, and without them, it makes it difficult to truly assess what they did and the impact on preventing infections. In slide 59, I think if there was one point I should emphasize in a presentation, it would be to follow the manufacturer's instructions. Many healthcare workers assume that the mere application of a disinfectant to a surface and wiping it off is sufficient to achieve disinfection, but that may not be the case, especially if the surface has actually got some bioburden on that may not be immediately visible. If you look on the labels of products such as detergent disinfectants, you'll note that there are two sets of instructions. one for using the product as a cleaner, and the other for use of the product as a disinfectant. For disinfection, the labels make it clear the surface needs to be pre-cleaned, and the product must remain wet on the surface for the duration of the contact time. Bottom line, read the labels and use the products accordingly. Sampling, slide 60. You've often heard questions raised, should we be sampling or monitoring the environment on a routine basis nowadays? I don't think there is a basis for routine environmental sampling in modern times, but I do think there are a few legitimate situations where sampling can provide useful information. Two possible scenarios would be to document the effectiveness of cleaning or disinfection, or to assist in outbreak investigations. In slide 61, this is one example where Dr. Phil Carling from Boston conducted a survey using a fluorescing compound to evaluate the effectiveness of cleaning procedures. And in this study, conducted in a number of ICUs, he sampled a variety of surfaces. This particular slide shows surfaces that were appearing to be more effectively cleaned and surfaces that the efficiency of cleaning was less than desirable. And the one thing I'd like to point out is when you look at the ones that were cleaned less frequently or less efficiently, those are part of the ones that are touched frequently by hand. So it's important to make sure that your cleaning regimen in your environments touch all the bases, and that includes the doorknobs, the light switches, and things that we forget about in the whole concept of cleaning the patient care area. I think it's important to also note that these cleaning studies do use a variety of assay systems. This particular one used a fluorescing compound. There are also some survey tools that use a luminescing enzyme ATPase with indicators that you swab on surfaces and then put into a photometer and read a result. You see a lot of the ATPase sampling done in food settings. Slides 62 and 63 talk about the use of sporicides in our environment, environmental management. This will be the last of the two last points I'll make today, as I see we are running close to the end of our time. First, sporicides. When you look at the problems we're facing with the occurrence of infections due to spore-forming organisms such as Clostridium difficile, we're facing a need for a sporicidal chemical that can be used on the large environmental surfaces. At present, there are no liquid chemical sporicidal disinfectants that are registered, at least here in the U.S., but I do know that EPA is attempting to respond to this need, and probably in the near future we will see some activity from that agency. You may have also heard or read some recent reports about the use of hydrogen peroxide vapor as a means of sterilizing or with a sporicidal agent disinfecting many surfaces in a room. This would be in slide 63. I think this is an emerging technology. This is basically all I will say about this and leave a more detailed discussion for a later teleconference later in the year. I would like to see more in-use studies to be able to evaluate the desirability of its use at this point. Some things I do note when looking at the literature is that it's important that the surfaces to be treated still be pre-cleaned, so you can't get away from the cleaning part of it. But also, too, the rooms need to be sealed to contain the sporicidal agent in the room where the surfaces are being treated. Additionally, the surfaces in a treated room tend to become repopulated with microorganisms within a day or two once the staff and the patients come back into the room. So I think this is something that merits additional research. Slide 64, and then through 69, as I say, I will just mention very briefly that these products that we use to control microorganisms in our healthcare environments are actually pesticides. And if we handle them and use them as such, we handle them with respect and with an eye towards safety, not only for our patients, but for ourselves. In the U.S., disinfectants are registered as pesticides. And as I say, these are potent chemicals, and so they may pose some risk to people who use the products and also to the patients who are present in the areas where they're used. In slide 65, this gives you some brief impact statements on our patients and our healthcare workers. In slides 66 through 69, we have some information. These are examples of questions you could be asking when you are selecting cleaning and disinfecting chemicals, and also some internet resources that are available for you to add to your research on the safety and the risk assessment that one needs to do when using these chemicals. Incidentally, the EPA information there on slide 69 has the link to the website where you can find those EPA lists of disinfectant products. Furthermore, all products should have material safety data sheets, and these are important sources of safety information that can be very, very helpful. Believe it or not, slide 70, this is a wrap-up. This was a very brief overview of cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization. So thanks again for being our audience today.
Lynn, thank you very much. Another outstanding teleclass. I know there's a lot of material to cover in terms of the basics of cleaning, disinfection, and sterilization, and it's tough to cover to even brush on it in 1 hour, but you did a wonderful job. And the slides 72 through slide 90, this is all material that was intended for people to take home and use as reference material. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. In any infection control journal around the world, you'll find somewhere in that journal an advertisement for a disinfectant wipe.
Mm-hmm.
What's your stand on the wipes? Even though on the side of the container it may say 5-minute contact time or 10-minute contact time, and yet clearly these are being used as cleaners instead of disinfectants. They really aren't leaving it that length of contact time. Surely that they aren't leaving it that length of contact time, because I wouldn't think that there's enough dampness in the container to be able to stay wet for 5 minutes. Is there any position on the effectiveness or lack thereof of disinfecting wipes?
That's an excellent question, and I hope I can attack it in a minute and a half. I think in practical terms, I do recognize that is probably the case. You will see people using the disinfectant wipes, maybe as a cleaner, or they're intending for whatever chemical is applied to a surface to just remain there dry, and perhaps hoping that any residual left on that surface could have some potency. Frankly, I think we're better served if we can do follow the use instructions as closely as possible. I would say the only way perhaps to allow that disinfectant wipe to approximate its potential activity would be to do a cleaning step on that surface first followed with the disinfectant wipe. But again, I know that people are trying to do more faster, and we have limited staff helping to do these processes. So I think my point would be, we recognize that it happens. I would say that perhaps we've been fortunate that perhaps these things have not created a significant or serious health risk. But the more we can follow the manufacturer's intended use instructions, I think the better off we'll be, and the more our confidence will be that these things will actually do what we expect of them.
Lynn, you always make me look intelligent, and I appreciate that. That's a difficult thing to do, but I thank you for doing it once again.
Well, you're quite welcome.
And so we come to the end. Thank you to all of you who have joined us. I look forward to meeting with you again very soon. And until then, goodbye.